nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
So good morning, everyone. This lecture is focused on quantum dots, and in particular on long-range strain, to give you a multi-scale phenomenon that is occurring at the nanometer scale. So you see something that you slightly different than what you normally see when you do electronic structure work or electronic device work. So let's start out with a description of the self-assembled indium arsenide, gallium arsenide quantum dots. Those are grown, these pyramidal or dome-shaped dots are grown on a substrate that is not quite fitting, meaning the indium arsenide quantum dots have a larger lattice constant than the gallium arsenide substrate material. And the way you can think about that is you're trying to grow something that doesn't quite fit, like where you place Legos on top of a surface, and you can only squeeze in so many until they don't want to be squeezed in anymore, and then they tend to fall apart. Well, these guys clump up, and they clump up in something that is pyramidal shape or dome shaped. So strain is a very critical element in the growth of these structures. And if what I sketched here is a sort of a sliver of a quantum dot, and too small to be realistic, but to give you an idea. And if you take a slice and look at the bond length through the structure along the lateral distance, what you see there is a small bond length change from roughly 0.059 to 0.064 or so. So it's actually a relatively small bond length change. So you might say, well, that doesn't seem like a whole lot. Well, if you think about orbitals interacting with each other from one atom to the next, you can at least in the back of your head sort of see that if you had an overlap of an s orbital interacting with an p orbital, and now you start to change the angle and the distance between those two slightly, on an quantum mechanical sense, you change the overlap of those matrix elements, or of those wave functions, quite significantly. So while strain might be a small effect on the mechanical disorder, a few percent, like 3, 4, 5%, it can be a tremendous effect on the band structure. In fact, indium arsenide bulk is around 0.4 eV. Around 400 millielectron volt is the band gap of bulk indium arsenide. That's one thing you should keep in mind. Now, if you put it into a strain environment like this gallium arsenide strain system on quantum dots, roughly the band gap doubles to roughly 800 millielectron volt. Okay, you double the band gap by a change of 4-5% of lattice constant. Okay, that's a huge effect. I mean, those are some numbers to keep in mind. If somebody asks you, is strain important in semiconductors? Yes, very important. Okay, and the picture you have to keep in mind is given here in this image that band structure is due to atoms coupling to another atom. And you change the overlap of these couplings dramatically if you just change the angle slightly or the distance slightly. Okay? That is what you have to keep in mind in the back of your head when people talk about strain and disorder. Right? That's the concept you have to have in the back of your head. All right. So let's make this a little bit more concrete. Let's look at a 30 nanometer diameter quantum dot that is 5 nanometer high and it's embedded in gallium arsenide. So one thing you may do in the computational procedure, as we discussed in the previous lecture, is that you start from a physical structure and you assume it to be ordered. Okay? And then you start this valence force field calculation where you think of these atoms as balls on the spring and you relax their position. Okay? So they relax themselves to minimize their total strain energy. So that moves the atom slightly, and then in the next step, we kind of lock these atoms in place and we calculate the eigenstates of this big Hamiltonian matrix that is constructed as a function, effectively, of these atom positions and the atom kind. Okay? That locks our Hamiltonian in place. All right. So then we calculate eigenstates and we want to figure out, well, what is the eigenenergy of this type of system, right? And there's a couple of different boundary conditions one can look at. One can say, well, I want to assume that I have this embedded quantum dot, and I can assume that maybe the system can just breathe out, right? I'm going to assume that there's nothing that constrains the edges of my computational box. That's one assumption I can do on the strain condition. And if I do that, and I increase the size of my box, if I make this box bigger and bigger and bigger, so I have this buffer thickness here, I'm ramping it from 4 nanometers around an indium arsenide quantum dot and make it as big as 20 nanometers in all dimensions. What you find is that the eigenenergy of your ground state of the electron is starting to move as a function of energy. You might say, that's kind of strange, right? I have a wave function that's confined in the center of the quantum dot, right? And now I make this buffer that's around it bigger and bigger. Your normal intuition would have been nothing should change, right? The wave function is in the center. There's a buffer around it, a barrier material. What would change? If I do this for an indium gallium arsenide quantum dot, so a little bit more gallium in it than in the pure indium arsenide dot, you see roughly the same effect, but not on a not as strong. So here on the indium arsenide dot, you change the gap by roughly 150 or more millielectron volts, right? The eigenenergy of the electrons. 150 millielectron volts is a huge value for an eigenstate to go up and down, right? If you were talking about optical line width optical emission, that's quite a big difference in frequency that you would get in your system. If I look at the whole state, it's kind of similar. There is a change of, you see the same effect, you basically get the gap bigger. But the movement of the state in the indium arsenide and the indium gallium arsenide is not as dramatic. It's just by 30 millielectron volt. So the holes don't move a whole lot, but the electron states seem to move a lot. And if I now compare this movement of the conduction band and the valence band, and by the way, this would be an interband transition, right? If I had a transition from an electron state into a hole state and I would emit a photon, that would be an interband transition. You basically see that the gap gets wider and wider the more you make this buffer larger and larger. The thing that's puzzling about this is we think of this buffer in a sense as a computational domain, right? It's not even a physical thing to us, right? Because we know there's some other quantum dots that are somewhere close by, and we really only want to simulate one of them, right? So keep that in mind, that's important. So there's something that we don't quite understand yet, and that's what I'm trying to drill down. I'm trying to set up a puzzle for you, okay? So what's going on? Really, the essence is that something changes in the band structure. So here is now the same type of quantum dot, and I'm walking along this line through the quantum dot, and I'm plotting the conduction band edge. For a small buffer, shown in a black solid line, you have a strongly bent conduction band edge. And for a large buffer that is going out to 20 nanometers, it roughly looks flat, it spikes up in the interface, and then it's flat on the inside, and then spikes up and is flat again. So changing the buffer size changes something dramatically inside the quantum dot, right? If I now take a cut in the vertical direction, I see something similar. The shape of the bands doesn't change in this direction much, but it's shifted up by 250 millielectron volt, right? And so also here, I can see on the left roughly 250 millielectron volt movement, and in the same, in the other direction, that same value. Something is not quite what we understand. The valence bands are, of course, a little bit more complicated because you have light hole and heavy hole bands in the system, and they split due to biaxial strain. But you see similar behavior for a small buffer shown in the black solid line. You see band bending, and for the longer buffer in gray, you see the band bending outside, but basically flat bands on the inside. And again, cut in the other direction, you see roughly the same effects. Something is not quite where we understand it normally to be. So let's try the following. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to locate myself in the very middle of this quantum dot, say at this point here on the top left, at the conduction band edge and the valence band edge. I'm just going to place myself on the conduction band edge, on the very middle of the quantum dot, and I'm going to plot my band edge energy as a function of buffer size. And that's this black solid line here. So it's going up as the buffer is getting bigger. And in the dashed line above it, I'm showing the eigenenergy of this quantum dot, right? My confined eigenenergy. So these guys move together. The band edge moves up, and also my eigenstate moves up. That's good, right? I mean, that's at least intuitive. We still don't know why they move up, but at least these guys move together, right? So nothing completely wrong with the simulator. And for the valence bands, we roughly see the same thing, right? We follow the band edge in the middle of the quantum dot on the valence band, and we follow the ground state of the holes, and they trace each other. Good. And the difference between them is the confinement energy, right? You have a particle in a box that's, for the electrons, it sits above the conduction band, and the holes, it, you know, sits below it, the valence band. So they trace each other. Good. So now let's do the following experiment. We take these curves, and now we assume that we take the biggest box that we can simulate and calculate the strain and calculate the eigenvalues. That means we're on the far distance here at 24 nanometer in this case, and we made the buffer as big as we can, right? And then 24 nanometers on the right side. And now we're chopping down the simulation domain in this white box and start from big and make it smaller and smaller and smaller. And in that white box, we only compute the electronic states. But we freeze them in place where they are. Okay? We freeze the atoms where they are, but we make the computational box smaller and smaller. Okay? So if we do that, the eigenstates of the electrons don't move anymore. And that means these states are unaffected by the electronic boundary condition, by the box. And if we do the same for the holes, we also find a flat line. The hole states don't move anymore. So the hard wall electronic boundary conditions have little effects on this calculation. But there's a long-range strain effect that dominates this whole structure. What that means is, if that buffer is too small, it feels, so to speak, the box, the edge of the box. And it's not a truly relaxed structure. Okay, so you need to make the structure extremely large for the strain to be truly converged on the inside. Okay? Because that's the underlying assumption, right? We need to make our artificial computational box so large until the strain doesn't change anymore. Because otherwise we superpose a boundary condition on our inside of the strain. So we have a multi-scale problem here. The strain is really long range, and the electronic structure is quite confined. We knew that the electronic structure was quite confined, right? We've looked at wave functions for resonant tunneling diodes and for some quantum dots, and we know that the wave function is on the inside. And we know it only exponentially decays into the buffer. So a little bit of buffer is good enough for the wave function, but it's not enough for the strain. Okay, so strain is really long range. So you can turn this around. Meaning, if the buffer size is really important for the central dot not to feel anything around it, that means if anything like another quantum dot is within that distance, it's going to feel it. So if there's another quantum dot within 20 nanometers in this lateral and vertical direction, it's going to be felt. Not quantum mechanically, but mechanically by the strain. Okay? Strain is really long range in these systems. The next thing you can try out is the following. You can say, well, you used a really strange boundary condition, right? You said, well, I leave the edge free. All these atoms on the edge, they can move wherever they want. So they could bulge out, or they could bulge in, or the whole surface could move. An alternative condition could be assuming that you really pack this into a periodic cell. So you have the box, and then you assume you have a periodic boundary condition in all three other directions. Effectively, you pack more quantum dots all the way around, right? That would be a periodic boundary condition. So, and if you do that, where you compute the ground states, the line of the free boundary condition that I had shown here is shown in red on the bottom right. If I assume a periodic boundary condition, I get the blue one. So it's roughly the same. Leaving the box completely open or making it periodic has roughly the same behavior. There's another one you can do. You can say, well, you know, this outside is gallium arsenide. Well, it better take on the gallium arsenide lattice constant. So why don't I just assume the edge atoms to be on the gallium arsenide lattice constant? And I call those fixed boundary conditions in NEMO 3D. And if you do that, where you lock the atoms at the surfaces to be at the gallium arsenide boundary condition, lattice constant, you get a different behavior. It starts from the top, meaning if your box is too small and you lock and strain on the edge, you really impose a completely different strain condition on the inside of your quantum dot. And if you make it larger and larger, all these three should roughly come together. Right? Really, for an infinite system, the periodic box, the free boundary condition, or the fixed to gallium arsenide really ought to be the same. And that's what you find in this numerical simulation. So those at least make intuitive sense. Excuse me. So now you can try to be a little bit more quantitative and try to figure out how far these strains reach. So we have done two experiments where we've taken a box like this. Again, we have a boundary condition where we can fixed all the way around. What we typically do, though, when we do NEMO 3D calculation, we have yet another boundary condition. It's actually a mixture of periodic, fixed, and open. So what that means is we assume on the bottom that we have a substrate, gallium arsenide. So we fix that. Then laterally we say, well, we have a periodic boundary condition because we know we're actually computing things in a pretty big sheet of things. And it's not open and it's not fixed. And we say on the top, well, we don't have really control on the top anyhow. We leave that top open. So the atoms on the top could bulge out if needed, for example. That's the typical boundary condition we use in NEMO 3D for strain calculation these days. And here's a similar experiment, but now instead of making all the domains of the same size and making it bigger in all three dimensions, we've fixed a ratio between distance and height. So here we're expanding the sensitivity to distance laterally versus height. And we look at the slope of these eigenstates and look at the deeply buried dot, and we compute the difference between the mixed boundary condition and the fixed boundary condition for the electron ground state and the electron excited state. And here we see something similar where both boundary conditions tend to converge for lateral distances that are pretty big at 140 nanometers. And we do the same thing for the holes on the bottom. Now let's do a different analysis where we look and make the vertical expansion larger than the lateral expansion. What we find is that these states are converging at much smaller distances. The result between the two boundary conditions turn out to be the same for smaller lateral distances, that where we expanded the height much more dramatically. That indicates that the strain is actually very much vertically oriented rather than laterally oriented. And in fact, you can find experimentally that quantum dots like to grow on top of each other. There's lots of experiments now that show where people have built quantum dot stacks, and they grow on top of each other because they preferentially align themselves, which tends to minimize the overall strain in the overall system, rather than having, if you grow multiple quantum dot layers, that they don't align themselves. They actually align themselves. That is due to the vertical orientation of the strain. And intuitively, you can look at that as well, where you say, well, if you start out with gallium arsenide, and indium arsenide is a larger lattice constant, it needs to contract laterally, and it expands vertically, biaxially strained. And if you grow a couple of layers, it's mostly vertical, and then it clumps up. So it remains roughly vertically strained, and then in the lateral dimension, you really have gallium arsenide dominating. Okay. So here is the same experiment where we look now at D and H, and D over H is fixed to 2. In this example, we have now looked at the effect of the capping layer. So we played with the distance. How far away do you need to make this buried quantum dot from the substrate boundary condition? What are the effects of the lateral dimension, and what is the effect of capping? Because those are three different sizes, in a sense, right? Capping is something you actually could control experimentally. You might want to have a smaller cap or a larger cap if you can maybe tune your quantum dots. So here are now the eigenenergies as a function of lateral distance and for three different caps. And it's not written on this slide how large A is. I have to put that on the slide. But the message here is that if you tune the cap, so if you have an 11 nanometer cap or a 17 nanometer cap or 23 nanometer cap, you can actually tune the eigenstates of your central system. Okay, so you have actually a design parameter in which you can play with tuning the energies of your atom, of your quantum dots. You don't change per se the form or shape or composition anymore of the quantum dots. Actually, I take that back. You seem to change the strain in it, which might change the form and shape a little bit, but you don't change the composition anymore, right? You're not changing the number of atoms in the quantum dot or anything. But changing the strain layer on top seems to change what happens in the inside of your dot, which is a tuning, an engineering parameter. So dots, the other thing is that with the testing for B, we can sort of sense that how sensitive are we to feeling another quantum dot that is virtually sitting in our distance neighbor, okay? And these dots are coupled via strain, and only if they're very close are they coupled quantum mechanically. So the summary of this section is that strain is the source of the creation of these indium arsenide quantum dots and gallium arsenide. So it's very important for the mechanical properties of this material, of the arrangements of the atoms. It's a very long-range phenomenon. It reaches further vertically than horizontally. That means quantum dots will grow on top of each other. And electron wave functions are confined in the central quantum dots, and it can be computed in a smaller domain. Right? So strain is computed in a huge domain, and then you can chop down your simulation domain to be something smaller that is critical to the electronic structure. Are there any questions on that? Clear as mud?